Good morning, afternoon, and evening, fellows of the nether regions. Welcome to another episode of the Trebe Regor podcast. My name is Spencer Zimmerman.
My name is Sarah Zimmerman.
And today's movie is called God's Not Dead. Very intellectual film. I can't wait to bring this one to you guys. Also, very excited today. Today we have a very special guest with us. Her name is Caitlin. Caitlin, welcome to the Trebe Regor podcast.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here.
Caitlin and I took intro to screenwriting together at our alma mater, and just wanted to invite her here today to help us delve into this one. We're really going to need an extra set of hands here, and an extra pair of glasses.
You can't see it, but I'm wearing glasses.
All right, let's get started. We got to explain the plot, which will be a real doozy. Yeah, it is an LOL situation.
Lol.
Here. Lol.
We have plots. We have subplots. We have characters. We have sub-characters.
So the basic plot of this film is it follows what I would call lovingly a bland man. A main protagonist who was a white, straight, Christian male who looked like every man I've ever seen in the world.
Simultaneously every man I've ever seen and no man I've ever seen. A real Adam Driver effect, I would say.
Oh, Adam Driver at least sticks out in your memory. I mean, this guy, I couldn't pick him out of a lineup.
See, arguably, I cannot wipe his image from my eyelids. I did draw a little picture of him in my margins.
That is the most accurate drawing of him, I think.
I couldn't tell you. It's just him in a blank sheet of paper, and I can't tell if you're referring to that drawing there or the blank sheet of paper when you're describing
his face is made up of four lines, and it describes him perfectly.
Anyways, so the bland man was, what was his name?
Joss Whedon. My apologies, Josh Whedon.
Josh Whedon, yes.
That's right. An obvious stand-in for Hollywood tycoon Joss Whedon. Josh enrolls in an intro-level philosophy class. And on the first day of class, the professor strides in, and the professor is a militant atheist. Really just assumes that everyone else in the class is an atheist, or if you're not, that you're an idiot.
Actually demands everybody to be an atheist in his class.
Yep, literally makes them sign a piece of paper that says, God is dead.
And we see him later declare himself God in that classroom.
At one point, the professor literally says to Josh, Josh, there is God in my classroom, and it's me.
And I am a jealous God. And then he followed that with something that clarified what he meant by that.
Which I can't remember at this
moment. Frankly, no.
So this professor makes everyone sign a piece of paper that says, God is dead, the titular line. And one student, bland man, says to the professor, I can't do it. I can't sign the piece of paper.
I will not say God is dead.
So, of course, Josh, the true bland man hero of this film, then takes it upon himself to prove his professor wrong in a series of 20-minute lectures and then eventually debates in class. And 3 is the total number.
No, and is that not just simply not the greatest question of all time?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a never-ending mm-hmm. story.
Is God alive or is God dead? I mean, okay, yeah. Hey, guys, let's go search the answer to God's existence. I mean, is that not the most overwhelming thought you've ever been presented in your life or what?
We talk a lot about the warm pockets that films can nestle in. It didn't need to go there. It didn't need to make me feel good. Mm-mm. It made me think.
Mm-hmm. This was not a comfort food film. This was not chicken noodle soup for the soul. This was gazpacho.
You leave it saying, you know what? I am smart.
I have thoughts. I think about things.
I'm the Josh Whedon of my own life.
Let's get back to Josh, shall we?
That's why he was bland.
That's
because every person could identify with him.
Which is so amazing about that character, because who is God? But not everyone.
But I would have to say, I was surprised because I truly expected this film to be like a very one-on-one look at Josh and his journey to triumph. However, really along the way, we're introduced to several, eight characters who all have their own individual struggles with God and the ones they love. I made a chart that is, it's sort of a grid system.
Now this, folks, is why we have Caitlin on the podcast today, is she brings things to us like this that just simply blow our minds. If you can picture a grid for us, folks, I'd say 8x8.
And you can see I shaded in the squares between characters who did interact, like speaking to each other. I did more little boxes inside for the characters who were in the same room as one another. And then anytime there's slanty lines, it means it's the same character represented in the grid.
It looks beautiful. It's a work of art.
Thank you. I will be scanning it later for the folks at home, for the true fans. So some other characters in addition to Josh. Truly, I think it depends on what we mean by important character. Because I think if we're discussing characters who go through some sort of arc, then I do believe Josh, Radisson, and Radisson's girlfriend. I don't believe she was named.
Radisson is the professor.
Yes, Radisson is the professor, not the hotel chain. I do believe that the three of them were the characters who experienced the biggest arc. Because meanwhile, see, we have some characters like our Reverend, who is in many scenes and does step in and touch many lives, but ultimately does not change himself through the course of the movie.
Finally, a character that's honest about the fact that they can be a pastor, a reverend, and...
A minister. He referred to himself as all three at various times.
He said, you know what? I know religion. I know God. And I know that he loves me, and I will spread my word however I want to.
And we also have a liberal blogger as one of the major characters.
Yes.
She was a fiery one. And I don't just say that because she was a redhead. I also say that because she would challenge you on your core beliefs.
She had, I would say, the doggedness of an Ann Coulter with the belief system of a Rachel Maddow.
She, at one point... walked up to an actual cast member of Duck Dynasty as he was walking into church with his wife.
Berated him.
She actually said to his wife, I'm surprised to see you out here. I expected you to be at home, barefoot and pregnant.
This Duck Dynasty guy, he presents himself as, you know, a guy that lives in the woods, you know, doesn't get a haircut, just shaggy, dirty. But really, this man is a theological master. He basically says to us that everything is temporary, but Jesus is not. Now, this hits so close to me because it's so true to us.
Wow.
So true to us as a species, as humans.
I would like to say, I'm just referring back to the chart really quickly. The chart, if you aren't familiar, was I mentioned earlier in the podcast. But I did just notice, actually, that the reporter that we're discussing truly only had one character foil in the film.
I know which one you're talking about.
And we have not discussed him yet.
Dean Cain was in this movie.
In perhaps, like, a career-changing role.
Oh.
Like, we think we've seen all Dean Cain has to offer in his first 50 years of life, but ho, ho, ho.
Thank God he was on hiatus from Law & Order SVU so he could film this movie.
Now, I was in the minority here. I had to lean over to you ladies and say, who is this man? Who is on screen right now? You said Dean Cain. I was like, okay, who's Dean Cain? You said, this man has achieved greatness. He's been Superman on TV. That is fit for legends. And that this man, he was so disturbing.
Like, I feel like we need to just be clear for the viewers. Like, dark is in, like break up with your girlfriend because she has terminal cancer dark. Who is, we should mention, the reporter who ambushed Duck Dynasty outside the church?
The liberal blogger.
Discussing Rev Dan, I think that he, if you actually refer back to my chart, I do believe that he and Dean Cain are sort of positioned as opposite ends of a morality spectrum in which Reverend Dan does not actually grow at all over the course of the film because he has no true growing to do because he's already set in his own faith, whereas Dean Cain also does not grow because he is beyond saving.
That just brings us back to one of the central themes of this film, which was duality. It was yin and yang, good, evil, man, woman, atheist, God.
That is such an ancient cultural belief. Like, can you believe they have invoked this thought within us from just watching this movie? Mm. Breaking down the yin-yang.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what is so... That is why we created this podcast. It is diving into these misunderstood films that invoke such deep theological, philosophical debate among a group of people.
I would say that not since German Expressionism have we seen better play of light and dark on film. I think we also, along with duality, I'm glad you brought that up, because I also think plurality played a really significant role in this film.
And morality.
Yes, cultural plurality in the presence of, we had three sort of vaguely ethnic characters. We had one was Martin Yip, who was a Chinese classmate of Josh's, who was sort of dealing with a conflict of faith, basically from going to the class and then reporting back to his father, who was always in cars.
In suits.
His father was always in a car on the phone.
Yes. And then you also had Aisha, who was a Muslim girl who secretly wished to be Christian but was being repressed by her father.
Violently repressed.
Yes, violently repressed.
She was beaten out of the house.
Yes.
She was kicked out as soon as her father found out she was listening to the Bible on her iPod.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, to complete the trifecta, we had, you know, I'm going to be perfectly honest, I did not catch his name, but there was an ambiguously African sort of counterpart, it seems like a sister ministry situation, mm-hmm. who was visiting Rev Dan. We are not sure where in Africa he was from. We do know that he was quite impressed by the existence of rental cars and took a 36-hour flight to get there.
And we still haven't addressed my favorite character of the film, who is really just another feisty woman. A lot of feisty women in this. Joss.
His girlfriend.
Oh, boy.
We are loved here. Her. I loved this person so much.
Sylvan, her name is Cassidy Gifford. She's actually the daughter of known TV host Kathy Lee Gifford. Every once in a while, every generation, you see an actor who I think says to their scene partner, I'm going to be up here and I'm gesturing to above my own head. And you better meet me. You better meet me, Shane Harper. And I think, early call, Cassidy Gifford is this generation's Kate Blanchett.
She kept this man in line like I have never seen in my life. And I just love that in a woman. That is such a brilliant quality, that you were just able to command a person like that.
As soon as she found out that Josh had not signed the sheet of paper and was now having to challenge his professor, she went right off on him. No, you cannot do that. She said, I'm sorry, I have the next 50 years of my life planned out. That's just the way I am. And got mad at him for potentially getting a bad grade that would potentially ruin their future plans of being successful people.
Right. She was a real Lady Macbeth.
Another major theme of this film, let's address it right away. I mean, this film was created by a Christian group of people that felt that they were not being represented enough in Hollywood. That message comes loud and clear.
They give it to us direct and with a lot of flavor.
Tastes like chicken.
But they didn't only limit the exposure of the underrepresented to Christians in America.
No.
They had, first of all, the one that we've already discussed, Dean Cain, not represented enough in cinema.
At all. No. You know, I want to see more Dean Cain.
Exactly. Professors with goatees.
Yes.
You do not see those many times.
Especially ones that barely connect.
Oh, the film also showed the logistics of getting a rental car. We don't see that enough. I mean,
the gritty underbelly of the rental car world is one that has been sadly... I don't need another movie about undercover cops. What I want to know is what's going on in Enterprise.
We don't just get the quick, stopping at the counter, jump cut, you're in the rental car. No, this one, we get the initial call to the rental service. We get a second phone call. We get the rental guy showing up with the car. The car doesn't work. But he still has to sign, and sign here, and sign here, and sign here.
And you know what? You're annoying me, you know.
Exactly. You always get a little bit annoyed by the rental car guy. That's shown here. Never shown before. One final thing that you don't see is, at the beginning of the film, the professor says to the class, anyone who doesn't want to work hard can leave now. And immediately, one of the students says, I'm not doing that.
Just ups and walks away.
Who always see that in movies. The professor says that. But nobody ever has the to leave.
Exactly. Such a subtle, we love subtleties in these movies. That is absolutely such a subtle little touch that we love. All right, so I would like to move on to the rest of this movie. Basically, what we have here is a theological projection, really, if you were to ask me. This is what I live for. This is what I love. I love this topic. So I couldn't wait to dive into it. So we are at the first 20 minutes. I think they summed it up beautifully in about two. And I believe a woman said, you know, if God doesn't exist, who created the universe? And we are presented with the idea that if God doesn't exist, then who created God?
I was a real coleslaw of doubt and possibility, honestly, in each of the debate, every classroom sequence in the film.
He went on to describe, he went on in depth and went on and it, so beautifully. Basically, he got to points where he said, without God, you know, there is no moral baseline. There is no indiscretion between what is good, what is wrong. Without God, we are left just for the wolves, basically. Mm-hmm. Also, he gets and touches on free will. He begins to say that God's intention is for you to reach him with your free will intact. And he went on further to say that this is why there is evil in the world, which is such a beautiful thought. It's disturbing. It's a wonderful contrast mm-hmm. in the worst way.
He wants people to have free will, but also it sort of seemed as if it was also like evil is kind of like a test. It's like a test on Earth. Mm-hmm. To see if you are good enough for God's kingdom.
What is Earth if not God's classroom? And what is this university classroom if not Radisson's classroom?
And, you know, there's a word I like to use. It's methodology. And I'll give you the exact definition of it real quick. It's how we approach the question of truth and knowing. And I loved the methodology of this movie.
But I did write down, can we only have morality under religion? Because I do think that was another thing.
How often does somebody bring you the question, can we have morality without religion?
Not often. Rarely. Not on an episode of Grey's Anatomy, I can tell you that.
Exactly. There's another term I like to use. It's epistemology. I will also give you the definition very quickly. It's the theory of how we know what we know is true and false. And that's the epistemology of this movie dove so deep. It said, you know what? Let's just lay out some stuff that we're going to show you is true. We're going to tell you, and we're going to show it to you right here in front of your eyes. Mm-hmm. And that is what I loved.
But I do believe that what this film is sort of putting forth is that perhaps, I think that we sometimes like to think of it as if we are all, as if we're watching God and the devil play football. But I think that what we must consider is that perhaps God is not the football player. God is the football field. We are the players. And the devil is the Buffalo Bills.
You know, moving on a little bit in this movie, I think we broke this movie up into thirds. We'd cover the first and second third. We'd like to move on to the last third of this movie.
The Holy Trinity, I would say.
Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And we're really smoothing on into the Holy Ghost.
It certainly was the spookiest part.
It was heart-wrenching. It was an emotional roller coaster.
Yes, this is the third of the movie in which we discover that the professor actually does believe in God, and he just hates God. And it turns out that his mother died when he was at a young age, and he has since been angry at God for letting her die.
I think what sort of was revealed as a flaw in the professor's logic was that he was sort of arguing, it seemed, that God couldn't exist because something this horrible never would have happened if there was a God. However, he would constantly invoke God in the sort of present positive tense, mm-hmm. as if to say, why did he, as if he was honestly questioning Joss Whedon, why did this happen? Like, you, a man of faith, tell me why your God did this to me, because I honestly want to know. This is not rhetorical.
And then he later said, I hate him for it. Mm-hmm. I hate him.
That was the sort of climax moment, which he admitted that he hated God.
The A Few Good Men cross-examination of the film. Because then Joss Whedon said, how can you hate something you don't believe in? And at that point, every single student in the class stood up and said, God is not dead.
Yes.
They said, this is what we stand for.
Literally, they stood up.
This is just a good place to bring up the thought that, you know, there is no coincidence in film.
There's no coincidence in God's world. You know, if a Christian sees a coincidence, they say, well, thank God for that. I don't want to say, but I think film is our, it's kind of our religion. We see God through art and the through theater. Creation, through acting, mise-en-scène.
Art is a form of, you know, it's people attempting to create their meaning of life, their meaning of the universe. They're trying to prove its existence through their art. But really what the majority of them find out in the end is that their art is ultimately just, it's only a creation of their own world. Therefore, it's just this cryptic thing to anybody else that only you understand what is the meaning of this stuff. And then ultimately at the end, you find out that it's just all meaningless, you know. And here we have a film bringing this to us in such a polite manner, because it's not an easily digestible thought.
Certainly not. We're still chewing on it right now. There's a cud for you.
You know what, folks? I think we can all sense this team winding down here. We are so happy we could bring this film to you. It's honestly, it's been an emotional adventure. Mm-hmm. It's been mind expanding. And we're so happy we could be the ones that bring it to you. Thank you again for joining us at another episode of the Trebe Rigor podcast.
We'd invite our listeners to please review us on iTunes if you're enjoying the show.
And again, I would just love to thank Caitlin for joining us. I thought she brought such a splendid perspective to this movie. Love, I'm so happy that out of all our episodes, she joined us for this one, because it was, we needed an extra hand, that's for sure.
I think our intro to screenwriting class certainly helped us with this one.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, Professor Joe. Shout out to Joe. Yes. Joe, thank you, Joe.
Hope you're listening out there. Go to bed.
So, we thank you again. And my name is Spencer Zimmerman.
My name is Sarah Zimmerman.
And my name is Caitlin Moore.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Trebe Rigor podcast.